The first question actually is not, it doesn't have a really easy answer. So, but it's a question that I would like to ask to Helen, if possible, and I got a little bit inspired from what was said on the US building stock. So, a lot of the building stock that needs to be retrofitted very often, just as in Europe, this building stock is actually building stock that is owned with people with maybe low or middle income. And today we have seen that, you know, daylighting, lighting, low carbon solutions are also a matter of not only environmental sustainability, but also social and economical sustainability. We have seen, on the other hand, like very advanced technological solutions like electrochromic glazing, but there might be many others, many other technologies. So for Helen, you know, the question is, how realistic are that these solutions are going to be implemented in real life? And also, if they are implemented, how can we balance the environmental sustainability? Because these are normally like high-end projects with the social and economic aspects.
Wow,
that's a good question.
You know, how realistic is it? I mean, I think it goes back to what Mark says. They have to be easy to install. They have to be easy to use. And of course, you've got to get to a point where they make sense economically. If I take a little step outside of the daylighting piece, the passive house community has done a really good job in North America in actually positioning themselves and demonstrating that the additional cost of doing basically the building and in particular the envelope right is not that much. And with in combination with some grants, incentives from government, they've been able to actually position themselves for low-income housing development. And so, you know, you can see that it could be possible, but the complexity of, you know, what we saw for controls, you know, that has to be to get to mass market, as Mark said, they really have to be really easy to use, you know, basically foolproof, because, you know, people will just override it. Even if it is cost effective to go in the building, if it doesn't work, then, you know, people are ingenious, right? They'll put tape over fences and so I think it comes down to we have to have a combination of the carrot and the stick to be able to drive a lot of these technologies can get down to lower cost if you get to economies of scale. But, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, you have this really disincentive. Our whole construction process is not set up to incentivize, I guess, innovation, at least on the facade side. I mean, I think I see the LED world, the lighting world, has been really fast at adoption, and they don't care about obsoleting their product lines. But on the facade, there's a lot of risk associated with putting stuff on the building. It's hard, if it goes wrong, it's hard to and expensive to get down. So we have to figure out what policy incentives, what codes, and what tools can be developed to really create. You need to create an ecosystem where it's actually possible to drive new developments into the market, and, you know, and manage that risk that people are taking. So, no, it's really not an easy. I'm sorry, I'm kind of rambling, but I think it's a really difficult question. If we knew what to do, I guess we would have done it by now.
I perfectly agree. To my understanding, take-home message is that is really a policy issue mainly, I would say.
To get to
To
the
get
economies of scale, you need to get it as business as usual. But then there's the complexity thing, right?
Yeah, real good. I mean, the thing is, Helen, you said before, we have most technologies, but the technology, we have the concept of the technology, but we haven't got it to the point where it's where it needs to be. There's still more R&D needed. And investment, just investment, company investment. But they won't invest if they don't have the policy. Get it back to your point. If I'm a company, how much am I going to invest in something if I don't see the policy to support it?
That's right.
So it's not just one, it's a whole integrated cycle.
Yeah.
Right. You can't
yeah.
solve one. There's multiple problems. You just can't solve one and expect the train to move. There's lots of moving parts that we have to address.
Yeah. I guess it's also, again, a political choice. For example, if we have, you know, we have a rating system in Europe with class A to E for energy. Is it really convenient to go from for some buildings to C to A instead of going for those that are G to E, for example? So that there, I guess, it's not only technology, but again, the political approach, the political decision.
I would say the existing buildings is even this is a real sticky problem. Mm-hmm. I think in, you know, having done the work that Mark's funding, Star Technologies would do, it's been very clear that someone said, you know, it's actually cheaper and easier to knock down a building and rebuild it than it is to actually retrofit the building. And that's obviously a problem when we're talking about embodied carbon.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And I would move now to Luis with a question on the urban planning side. So referring a little bit to what Justin has been proposing here. In my case, for example, I know quite well the situation in Europe. So one, I wonder in the US, what would be the problems and limitations in implementing urban initiatives where, there is an actual change in urban planning that goes towards low carbon neighborhoods, possibly, and daylight, of course, but mainly low carbon.
I'll answer that question by just emphasizing, I mentioned that we have this tool that we use when looking at individual buildings or campuses or developments for our clients to look at holistically carbon emissions. And we talked about the fact that embodied and operating, it really depends on the locale, the utility, the building type. But what always comes out as the largest carbon driver is the transportation, right? So it's people going back and forth. And that's even in locations, assuming adoption of EVs, et cetera, and in cleaner grids, that still ends up being predominant, 50% or more of the life cycle emissions. So, and it's honestly, with a lot of our projects, it's not something we can, as architects, a lot of times site is the site. You know, we try to, when we have those opportunities, advise the client for other opportunities. You know, I'd say that, you know, on the next scale, the thing that we're looking at for urban initiatives, a lot of it when we're working at the scale of campus, is looking at central utilities, district utilities, because there's a lot of efficiencies, simultaneous heating and cooling, from management resiliency, and for some of our clients, that's very doable. Others may be in a situation where they don't necessarily own the whole campus, and the economics and the management of that become incredibly, incredibly difficult, and typically are not implemented because of really logistical and finance. You know, it makes sense on paper, but it's how we really monetize that. And so we've lost that opportunity on some projects. Then I think that the next scale, I think, comes back to something we're talking about in buildings too, like when we're talking about quality of view, is just that our projects need to be successful no matter how, you know, they need to be successful, but they need to meet the client's programmatic perspective, whatever they're doing in the building. It also needs to be a building that's loved and used, right? And so, yes, it does need to have windows and it has to have places. And I think from an urban perspective, it needs to have those types of spaces where people can recharge and connect in places that really sort of facilitate the best experiences in for the occupants, for the people working there, what have you. I'm sure I didn't 100% answer the question. Maybe other panelists have other thoughts there too.
Yeah, but my take home message is mostly mobility is the big determinant.
Yeah.
And here you would say. And when you mean space for recharging, you mean indoor spaces.
Indoor or outdoor, we're looking at microclimates and those kind of, those are the cheapest spaces too. So in a lot of climates we work, we are doing microclimate studies and looking at, places that are comfortable at different times of the year, recognizing, those outdoor spaces are important as well.
Yeah, I mean, one thing real quick. Well, so after the pandemic, we're seeing, people aren't going to the offices, right? So we have lots of commercial buildings in the U.S. that have very single-pane windows. There's one project we're working with because they're converting it from commercial, which people may have accepted the single-pane windows. Now they're putting in vacuum glazing because when they turn it into a multi-family, when they put it into apartments, people aren't going to accept the single pane. So if we get more of that happening, it sounds crazy, but you know, that's good. That might be a way to get the glass to change. But I mean, again, mobility, I think you're right. It's important, but what does the future look like? Like, mm-hmm. how do we work and where do we live and all that? That whole demographic may be changing. So we should be thinking about not just designing for today, but are we going to design for 10, 15 years in the future, what that's going to look like? I don't know if you guys thought about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think even just those outdoor spaces related to whether it's a residential or office, like it used to be like those spaces weren't considered because they were not really in the program. That's not someone's office. It's not someone's residence. It's not interior square footage that they're buying. But I think post-pandemic, those kind of spaces that are attached to a unit or have an outdoor space, and yes, part of the people are thinking, I think, well, if there, you know, if there is another coronavirus, I can go outside. But I think it's also that, to your point, the places are being used much more flexibly. The office spaces need to be much more compelling to draw the workers back to the place. And so those kind of amenities become really important when people have more choice in the kind of space that they're going to spend their lives. And so, I mean, we redid our own office building. It was terrible timing because we all came back to work and then we got out of work. We worked from home again, but we knew how to do it for 6 months because we reconfigured our office to be much more hybrid, to have much more social spaces and make it more compelling for our staff to, you know, do what we need to do.
Thank you so much. Anyone from the panelists that wants to add something, some reflection?
It seemed to me on your subpaths that if maybe there are other people addressing this, I think it would be helpful to see more implemented examples of buildings or strategies that go a lot further to push the envelope towards decarbonization, particularly in the realm of lighting, daylighting. The two examples that you showed were interesting presentations on their own, but really to Mark's point about showing examples that have been implemented and are successful and being able to quantify the measures of success would be hugely helpful for the effort at large.
Yeah, I agree completely. Luckily, we have a list of 25 case studies that are actual buildings, most of them. So hopefully we will get to that point, but that's the scope. It's for the goal.